This call is being recorded by the meeting organizer. By staying on the call, you are giving your consent to being recorded.
Okay, Kathy, you've got the floor.
Okay. Hello, everyone. I'm Kathy Arrington, and I'm up here in the first. Excuse me, and I have a head cold. I'm going to try not to cough. If I do, I apologize in advance. I'm also here with Dana Bearfield, who is our Assistant Circuit Director. And Dana came to us from the Agency for Persons with Disabilities. So at some point, I'm going to turn it over to Dana for a little bit, and she's going to talk about the APD application process, and then we'll come back to me, and I'll talk about the SSI application process. But what I wanted to talk about today, I know that last summer there was a training on appointment of attorneys, AALs, for children with special needs. What I want to focus on today is the various developmental disabilities that will qualify a child not only for an attorney ad litem, but also for services under APD, as well as financial benefits and insurance benefits under SSI. Chapter 39.01305, subsection 3C. Provides an attorney ad litem for a child with a diagnosis of a developmental disability as defined in 393.063. When you turn over to 393.063, which was amended in 2016, there are various developmental disorders that are outlined in that statute, and those are what we're going to talk about today. You should have received handouts that I was able to obtain discussing each one of these developmental delays or disorders. Most of them came from the Mayo Clinic, which is a fairly, well, it's a very good resource for information. But subsection 12 under 393.063 talks about developmental disability in a global fashion. And it means a disorder or syndrome that is attributable to intellectual disability, cerebral palsy, autism, spina bifida, Down syndrome, Phelan-McDermid syndrome, or Prader-Willi syndrome that manifests before the age of 18 and constitutes a substantial handicap that can be reasonably expected to continue indefinitely. And what we're going to do is go through each one of those disabilities. We're going to do it in an alphabetical fashion, and we're going to start with the autism spectrum disorder. Now, those of you who are familiar with the DSM may know that we are currently under the fifth edition of the DSM. DSM stands for Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. And as I said, we're now on the fifth edition, and in that fifth edition there was a change made as it relates to autism. Previously, under the DSM, various forms of autism occupied various diagnoses. You had Asperger's syndrome, you had childhood disintegrative disorder, pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified. And now all of those diagnoses are included under autism spectrum disorder. And it is a condition that is related to brain development that impacts how a person perceives and socializes with others. And I'm going over the autism spectrum disorder handout right now. Probably on the lower end of that spectrum, and when I say lower end, that means a child who is more highly functional would be a child that would have previously been diagnosed with Asperger's. On the high end of that spectrum, children who have great difficulty functioning would be those that are diagnosed with childhood disintegrative disorder. But elements of what I'm getting ready to go over are going to be found in any of these various previously identified disorders that are now all under the autism spectrum disorder. ASD begins in early childhood and eventually causes problems functioning in society. And many of you who are aware of children that have autism, that some children with autism can be highly intelligent, highly functional, but they cannot socialize. They have no social skills. They have a lot of issues dealing with other people. They tend to retreat into their own little worlds, and that impairs their ability to function in society. Children often show symptoms of autism within the first year. A small number of children develop normally in the first couple of years, and then they hit about the age of 3, and they start developing autism symptoms. There is no cure for autism. However, intensive early services, if the disorder is diagnosed at a very young age in a child, can help a child with their functioning. And let me digress for just a minute. One of the reasons why I wanted to do this presentation is so that all of you can take this information back to your child advocate managers, who in turn can take them to your volunteers and educate them on these various developmental delays and disabilities so that they can be looking at the children whose interests they represent to see if they are recognizing any of these symptoms in any of the children that they see on a regular basis. While we don't profess to be experts, and we would never make an independent diagnosis of a child unless, you know, you have a doctorate in psychology and you're qualified to do that, we certainly can make recommendations that a child be tested. And some parents don't get their children tested. Some children don't get tested until they get into, say, voluntary pre-K or kindergarten. And the earlier you can address these issues with children, the better off the children are going to be. I'm going to briefly mention childhood disintegrative disorder because I don't think that we see a whole lot of those children, but that's probably the saddest among all of the autism diagnoses. Those children start out developing normally. They meet all their developmental milestones, they communicate, they do everything that children of their age are supposed to do until they hit about the age of 3. And then they start to regress, and they start losing those skills they've developed to the point where they are showing signs of full-blown autism. And what's really sad is that because they're 3 years old, often those children are aware that they're losing their skills and they don't understand why. And that's something that would clearly be very, very difficult to explain to a child. Some of the cues or things you want to look for in terms of a child, whether a child falls on the spectrum, is their social action and their social interaction and their communication skills. And some of these children will manifest some of these symptoms. Other children will manifest all of them. And again, some children are highly intellectually functional. Others are borderline intellectually functional. But what you normally look for in determining whether a child has autism is a child who fails to respond to his or her name, appears not to hear you, resists cuddling and holding and affection, seems to prefer playing alone, retreating into their own world, has poor eye contact, lacks facial expression, doesn't speak or has delayed speech, or childhood disintegrative disorder loses the ability to say words or sentences that they previously had, can't start a conversation or keep one going, they speak with an abnormal tone or rhythm, may use a sing-song voice or a robot-like speech, they repeat words or phrases verbatim but they don't understand how to use them. I see a lot of echolalia in children that have autism spectrum disorder. They don't seem to understand or be able to respond to simple directions or questions. They're not aware of other people's feelings. Patterns of behavior that you see in children with autism spectrum disorder, they may perform repetitive movements such as rocking, spinning, or hand flapping. They also, and this isn't in the materials, but they also will display behavior that is called stimming. An example of that might be child may be perfectly willing or capable, able to read a book, but in reading that book, they will start poking at the book in just almost an aggressive, violent, repetitive manner, and it goes on and on and on and on, and That is an example of stimming, which is considered self-stimulatory behavior. It's comforting to the child. It's a little startling at first, but you will get used to it. A child that's on the autism spectrum disorder may engage in activity that causes self-harm, such as biting or headbanging. A lot of children with autism have to maintain specific routines or they be disturbed at the slightest change. They need structure, and if their structure is disturbed, it can cause a meltdown. Some children with autism have coordination issues, odd movement patterns, such as clumsiness or walking on toes. They'll have an odd, stiff, or exaggerated body language that they display. Often they're unusually sensitive to light, sound, or touch, but may be indifferent to pain or temperature. I think one of the hallmarks of children with autism spectrum disorder, or that are on the spectrum, they don't engage in imitative or make-believe play. They fixate on objects or activities with an abnormal intensity, and they also can have issues with specific food preferences, eating only a few foods because they don't like the texture of foods. The only other thing I wanted to mention about autism spectrum disorder is they don't really know what causes it. There's a lot of speculation as to what causes it, but one thing that has, I think, been established is boys are about 4 times more likely to develop autism spectrum than girls are. There is another disorder, and we're not going to go into any depth about it, called Rett syndrome, which used to be considered on the autism spectrum. I don't think it is anymore. It has a lot of characteristics of autism, primarily difficulties in communication. Children with Rett syndrome lose the use of their hands. They often lose the ability to walk. That is a disorder that is more predominant in girls. The next qualifying disability that is in the statute is cerebral palsy. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail with cerebral palsy. I think that most of us have known children with cerebral palsy, seen children with cerebral palsy. It can disorder that can run the gamut. You can have children with cerebral palsy who have issues with walking. The gait of a child with cerebral palsy can be very pronounced. They can focus or lean to one side when they walk. They can walk with an odd scissor-like gait or a crab gait. But on the other hand, that can be completely highly functional. I went to law school with a young man who had cerebral palsy, and you would not know he had cerebral palsy until he got up to walk. He now is a founder of a large insurance defense firm in New Orleans. He's done very, very well, highly, highly intelligent. He had more physical disabilities. And did not have any intellectual limitations. But the symptoms of cerebral palsy are variations in muscle tone, such as being either too stiff or too floppy, stiff muscles and exaggerated reflexes or spasticity, stiff muscles with normal reflexes, which is referred to as rigidity, lack of muscle coordination, tremors or involuntary movement, slow writing, delays in reaching motor skills, milestones, favoring one side of the body, difficulty walking, excessive drooling or problems with swallowing, difficulty with sucking or eating, delays in speech development or difficulty speaking, difficulty with precise motions, such as picking up a crayon or spoon, and seizures. Cerebral palsy can occur prenatally, due to some brain injury while the child is in utero. It can occur during the birth process, or it can occur after a child is born if they suffer some type of brain injury after their birth. There are also certain infections or health problems that occur during pregnancy cause or increase cerebral palsy risk to the baby, German measles, chickenpox, cytomegalovirus, herpes, toxoplasmosis, syphilis, exposure to toxins, and more recently the Zika virus infection. Illnesses in a newborn baby that can greatly increase the risk of cerebral palsy would include bacterial meningitis, viral encephalitis, and severe untreated jaundice. Again, I think one of the major issues with the child with cerebral palsy, and again, this is one that we would probably not necessarily notice and say, you need to have this child tested, determine if this child has cerebral palsy. That's probably something, if it's occurred either in utero or during birth or subsequent to birth, is going to be picked up by a gynecologist, OB-GYN, or a pediatrician. One of the keys to helping children with cerebral palsy be the best that they can be is to ensure that they have repeated, continual physical therapy and occupational therapy, and if possible, speech therapy, and attempt to ensure they don't have that constriction of the hands that you often see with children with cerebral palsy, or constriction of the legs, occupational therapy to help with their fine motor skills, and of course, speech therapy to help with their speech. The next disability that would qualify for an AAL, APD services, or SSI is Down syndrome. And again, we're not going to spend a whole lot of time on Down syndrome because I think that most of us have the ability to look at a child and determine whether a child has Down syndrome, and that's going to be a diagnosis that's going to be picked up very, very, very early for a child. Just to give you a little bit of information, it's a genetic disorder that chromosomal in nature. The syndrome varies in severity among individuals, causing lifelong intellectual disability and developmental delays. Some children with Down syndrome are highly functional. I've known a child here in Pensacola, or a young lady now, who was able to live on her own. Her parents lived nearby, and they helped her with the tasks of everyday living, but she was able to maintain a household, able to write checks, balance a checkbook, just engage in activities that were, I mean, it was good to see her able to do that. She recently had a commitment ceremony with a young man, and they are together, so. Down syndrome, again, can run the gamut. You could also have a child with Down syndrome who does not have that high level of intellectual functioning and will need care and assistance for the rest of his or her life. Children with Down syndrome have distinct facial features, and I think that's what I'm talking about when I say that they're readily or fairly easily identified. They tend to have a flattened face, a small head, a short neck, protruding tongue. I think the main characteristic we see is the upward slanting of the eyelids, unusually shaped or small ears, tend to have poor muscle tone. They also have broad, short hands with a crease in the palm, and I think that's one of those universal symptoms that you see. You look down at your palm, you can see all kinds of creases, but apparently a child with Down syndrome just has the single crease. They have relatively short fingers and small hands and feet. They're excessively flexible. Tiny white spots on the colored part of the iris. And again, their intellectual disabilities range from mild to moderate impairment. One of the other issues with children with Down syndrome that you have to be careful of is the complications that arise from the symptom itself. Children with Down syndrome and adults with Down syndrome have, I guess about 50% of them, have heart problems. There are also gastrointestinal defects. They're subject or prone to immune disorders, sleep apnea, obesity, spinal problems, and other problems as well. One of the major changes in the DSM-5 was with respect to what we used to call mental retardation, and is now called an intellectual disability. And the handouts you have in the materials that were sent out from the American Psychiatric Association. The Florida statutes were significantly amended in 2016, other than in one area, to delete any reference to mental retardation and substitute it with the reference intellectual disability. And that was in line with the changes to the DSM. The one place where there were no changes made, and I don't know if that was a glitch or an oversight, was in the criminal sections. They still refer to mental retardation, but that is no longer a correct word, and instead the definition or the term is intellectual disability. And there are three primary things that the clinician who is evaluating the child will look for in determining whether or not a child suffers from an intellectual disability. Previously, all that was focused on in the DSM was a child's IQ. And that is still a part of the evaluation, but that is not the sole part of the evaluation. Emphasizes the need to use both clinical assessment and standardized testing of intelligence when diagnosing intellectual disability. A clinician will still look at a child's IQ, and a child whose IQ is 70 or below is going to be considered intellectually disabled. However, they've also added two other prongs to the test. And look at adaptive functioning, and then whether the limitations occur during the developmental period. With respect to intellectual functioning and the deficits that are examined, the clinician will look at various mental abilities, reasoning, problem solving, planning, abstract thinking, judgment, academic learning, experiential learning, and they're measured by the IQ test. And again, typically an IQ score of 70 or below is what is needed to qualify a child for an intellectual disability. Deficits or impairments in adaptive functioning include skills needed to live in an independent and responsible manner. Limited abilities in these life skills make it difficult to achieve age-appropriate standards of behavior. Without these skills, a person needs additional supports to succeed at work, school, or independent life. And then lastly, the limitations need to occur during the developmental period, which means in childhood. IQs generally don't change over time. They don't generally improve. They may improve slightly, but they generally don't improve to any degree. So that's the third prong of the test, to look at whether the two areas that are being examined did occur during the developmental period. Okay. We just have three more developmental disorders that we're going to be looking at, and they're going to be pretty quick. Phelan-McDermid syndrome was added to the statute in 2016. It is a very, very rare disorder. There are only 400 cases diagnosed in the world. It is a genetic disorder. It is as a result of a chromosome deletion. And the symptoms that need to be examined. Oh, and let me back up. It's difficult to diagnose. There is a specific test that is used. And I apologize for the materials on this one. It didn't print very well. Printed just in this long column. But anyway, they use a special test called the FISH, which is fluorescence in situ hybridization. It's a genetic test. But the most common characteristics of children with this disorder is droopy eyelid, a pointed chin, prominently poorly formed ears, puffy hands, thin flaky toenails, a wide nasal bridge, hypotonia or poor muscle tone, a tendency to overheat, and a lack of perspiration. Behavioral characteristics include chewing on non-food items such as clothing, bedding, or toys, teeth grinding, tongue thrusting, hair pulling, aversion to clothes, decreased perception of pain and anxiety in social situations. Many of the children with Phelan-McDurbin syndrome also fall within the autism spectrum. They do also have some medical issues, and very few of the speech or toilet training skills. Prader-Willi syndrome has been on the list of those disabilities or syndromes or disorders that qualifies for ATD services. These children, this is, again, another rare genetic disorder that results in a number of physical, mental, or behavioral problems. I think the key feature in Prader-Willi syndrome is that children with that syndrome have a constant sense of hunger that usually begins when they're about 2 years old. They never feel full, and they want to eat all the time. And so clearly, unless you have a parent or caregiver that's watching their caloric intake, they're going to have obesity problems, and then they're going to have the whole host of health issues that result from obesity. The signs and symptoms that are present from birth are poor muscle tone, again, hypotonia, distinct facial features with almond-shaped eyes, narrowing of the head at the temples, a turned-down mouth, and a thin upper lip, generally poor responsiveness, and then they also suffer from underdeveloped genitals, which ultimately will develop into, will ultimately become underdeveloped sex organs. As they get a little older, again, they have that food craving and weight gain, poor growth and physical development, cognitive impairment issues, delayed motor development, speech problems, behavioral problems, sleep disorder, and then they may also have some skeletal issues that are associated with the disorder. Last disorder we're going to talk about is spina bifida, and again, I think that's one that many of you are familiar with. There are three kinds of spina bifida. Spina bifida occulta, that is the least symptomatic, which most people don't even know they have unless they have spinal imaging done, and it's a small separation or gap in one of or more of the bones. Spina occulta don't know they have it unless it's discovered imaging tests. Discovered during an imaging test, but it generally is asymptomatic. The second kind, which is a little more serious, is meningocele, which the protective membranes around the spinal cord have opening in the vertebra, forming a sac filled with fluid. However, the sac does not include the spinal cord, so again, this is one that is generally asymptomatic. Nerve damage is less likely, though later complications may be possible. This is often seen by a bump somewhere along the spinal cord or the spine on a child's back. And you see the bump, but it's closed. The skin is covering the sac. The most severe form of spina bifida, which is also known as open spina bifida, is myelomeningocele, and that is what you traditionally think of when you think of spina bifida. That's where the spinal canal is open along several vertebrae in the lower or middle back. Membranes and spinal nerves push through this opening at birth, forming a sac on the baby's back, exposing tissues and nerves. And that makes the baby prone to life-threatening infections unless and until that opening is closed. Probably, and anybody that's on the call that's had a child will remember that when you pregnant,
yes,
such an emphasis on making sure that you took your prenatal vitamins and uric acid, and that's the one thing that really serves to prevent spina bifida, and that's why prenatal care is so important. And why it's so important that we encourage the parents on our caseloads to make sure they get prenatal care and that they are taking vitamins that will prevent spina bifida. Okay, I'm going to briefly turn it over to Dana, and Dana's going to talk a little bit about ATD, as I indicated. All of these disorders and syndromes that I mentioned is established by appropriate testimony or appropriate information should qualify a child for APD services. So I'm going to let Dana talk about that. Good morning, everybody. I just wanted to go over briefly what I've experienced in this circuit regarding APD. To help you understand, APD has what they call a waiting list to get on services, a waiver wait list. And what that means is they have so many people that qualify for their services that they don't have the funds to treat them and to get them on their caseloads. So they go on a waiver wait list. Things change when the children are in the dependency system. It changes, and each circuit or region does their own between DCS and the community-based care and APD on how they'll treat these cases with the children. But if you've got a child that was on the wait list, the waiver wait list, and the child has been sheltered and they now are on your caseload, all they have to do, you have to let APD know, and they come off the wait list immediately. And what that means is they become on the waiver, so they have a waiver support coordinator. And that is somebody that is assigned to that child that will see that child monthly and ensure that child gets their needs met. And this really comes into play when you're looking at children that are at the point of aging out and you're looking for placement. APD can certainly help with placement throughout the state. APD has facilities. And so it is something, as I said, once you're on the support, the waiver, you have that coordinator throughout. You don't age out of APD services. You can refuse them, but the person that you're assigned to, your support coordinator, will be with you, their assigned child, indefinitely. And what I found in this circuit is a lot of the our community-based care program is not aware of APD services. So our staff would ask them if they are eligible for APD because we can't make the referral. They'll say no. And then they'll ask me, and I'll check into it. And I said, well, yeah, they're on the wait list. And if they're not on the wait list, it involves a application. And the agency should be able to give you, they should have the application, but if they don't and you need it in any area, just email me and I'll send you the application. And once your application is submitted to APD, then someone will come out and ensure that the criteria is met, and then they're on the waiver. Like I said, this is an agreement that APD has made with DCS and community-based care, and it's just another service that can get the child the children that we're appointed to services that they need. And they, like I said, they're really handy and they really come into play for placement, especially for the children that are, or the people on our caseload that are aging out. It is a very big help. And like I said, I just don't think the majority of community-based care staff are aware of the APD services that can be provided at no cost to the child, because as you know, children that are on, once they're removed, they're on Medicaid most of the time. Medicaid will pay. If you've got a child that needs behavior modification therapy, Medicaid will pay for it. The APD support coordinator knows how to get that done. It's got to be on an actual prescription pad like it is for an antibiotic, and the doctor can do it. They can lead you to the people that provide those services. So having a waiver support coordinator is paramount if you've got a child that meets the criteria for APD services. I do have handouts. They're sending me because I try to keep everybody informed. Anybody that would like any information on APD, if you'll just send me an email, I'll be glad to get that out to you. Or if you have any other further questions, I'll be glad to answer any questions that come up, because I try to stay current on how they're doing and what they're doing, so I can give that information to the people in our circuit. But it is statewide. So I hope I've given you a little bit of information that will help you in the future and knowledgeable of the services that APD provides. Okay, and last, I'm going to just take a few minutes and talk about SSI income for children with disabilities. And again, we're talking about SSI. We're not talking about SSDI, which is Social Security Disability Income or Insurance. That is for people who actually have a work history of work, the requisite number of months paid into paid FICA and or had FICA paid on their behalf, so they qualify for SSDI. We're talking about supplemental security income for children who do not have a work history. And most of our kids are not going to have a work history because these disabilities are going to manifest themselves at birth, and they're not going to be diagnosed as they're, you know, 15, 16 years old and may have a part-time job or a full-time job working and earning their own income. Social Security Administration considers a child disabled under SSI if there is a medically determinable physical or mental impairment or combination of impairments that results in marked and severe functional limitations. The impairment must be expected to result in death or have lasted or be expected to last for a continuous period of at least 12 months. And the income and assets of family of children with disabilities are also considered when determining financial eligibility. So it's a three-prong test. You have a disability, it's expected to continue it for at least a year or possibly result in death, and then they're going to look at the family's income and assets to determine whether a child is eligible for SSI. And when I say income and assets, they'll look at what the monthly earnings are, and Social Security Administration will look at what assets the parent may have, be it property, jewelry, stocks, bonds. Basically, it's going to be a similar inquiry in that respect to what our judges inquire of parents about regarding appointment of counsel for indigent parents. It sounds simple. It's not. It's very, very complicated. Anyone that's ever had a Social Security case knows that there are often denials at the early stages of the case, and it often isn't until you get to the administrative law judge who amasses all the evidence and gets all the information that a determination of eligibility is going to be made. They'll also reevaluate every couple of years to determine whether or not the disability is still in place. And this is not something that we would apply for on behalf of a child, but this is something that an attorney ad litem could apply for on behalf of a child, a caseworker could apply for SSI on behalf of a child because the department has custody of the child if the child's been removed. So this is something we can push entities to participate in. The only other thing I'm going to mention is what's called a presumptive disability. There are a list of disabilities that will be presumptively considered a disability to qualify or make a child eligible for SSI benefits, and a child can receive SSI benefits for a period of 6 months while the evaluation process is going on. Now, I gave you two handouts, and they actually provide different information in each handout. But under the one from the American Academy of Pediatrics, the presumptive disabilities include cerebral palsy, Down syndrome, and severe mental deficiency. Again, they use the phrase mental retardation in a child 7 years of age and older. There are also a lot of other presumptive disabilities that you can look at if you have a child with any of these other issues outside of a developmental delay, such as an amputation of a leg at the hip, total blindness, deafness, confinement to bed, a stroke, children with HIV infections, cancer. You know, be mindful that if the child's not already receiving SSI, they may be able to receive SSI. On the other handout, which is from a law firm which I had found online, they mention, again, mental retardation, outdated word, and they also mention autism would qualify a child for SSI. That's it, and if anybody has questions, I'm here. I'm not an expert on any of these disorders or syndromes. If you have a question I can't answer, I can certainly find the answer for you.
All right, any questions out there?
Lonnie. This is Tom Turcotte out of Circuit 7. I just have a comment about the autism for the APD.
Yes.
Just be careful that you don't rely upon what a therapist says, what any particular doctor says, and some vague diagnosis of autism that will not be good enough ordinarily for APD. I've learned over the last couple of years about the ADOS test, Autism Diagnostic Observation Schedule, and that appears to be the key test that's accepted for autism. So if you think there's autism, even if you have a diagnosis written down somewhere, you want to make sure you have that test done and ordered by your court, because apparently that is what APD ordinarily accepts, from what I understand.
What is the name of that test?
It's called, they call it ADOS, A-D-O-S. It stands for Autism Diagnostic Observation Schedule, and apparently that is the test for autism that APD is most likely to accept.
Thanks, and I think a big component of that is observation of the child, because autism is not a test where you draw blood and you can determine that the child has autism, but it is behaviorally based, so I would imagine the observation is key into the child's behavior.
And I, this is Michelle Ace from Circuit 12. What is the email address that we could get more information?
Sure. Dana's email is dana.bearfield, B-A-R-E-F-I-E-L-D, at, you know, and the rest of it, jal.fl.gov. Mine is Kathy, K-A-T-H-Y, dot Arrington, E-R-R-I-N-G-T-O-N.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
And I just wanted to tell Kelly, I just want to say thank you, Kathy and Dana. Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.